Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Imri, the host of the Wannabe podcast, the podcast that takes you from where you are now to where you want to be in 30 minutes or less. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I'm so excited that you're here. Just a quick reminder to get tickets to Wannabe Live, the Brand Builders Masterclass with myself and brand and marketing expert Prisca Moyesa. We'll be live on June 2nd in London Bridge. At the live show, we'll break down how to switch your business model when it's not working. We'll show you how we made money while we were still in side hustle mode. And we'll share how to get so comfy with your finances that you don't have to stay up at night. We want to see more women running businesses, so do come through. And we've added early bird tickets, so there's no excuse. Visit wannabelive.eventbrite.co.uk. This week, I'm excited to share that I am again joined by the futurist Natalie Kane. Natalie is the curator of digital design at the V&A Museum, and she's one half of Haunted Machines, a festival that explores the unexplained mysteries of technology. In today's episode, we talk about the questions you should ask yourself if you're building technology or a future-proof brand, and you'll find out what it's like to enter university when you're the first one in the family. And finally, we talk about public speaking and the discrimination that women face. Let's go. Who did you want to be before you became who you are today, and why?
Oh my God. I think my earliest memory is that I wanted to be a vet on Animal Hospital.
That is oddly specific.
Which is very specific. But I think I grew up really wanting to be either a vet or a cardiologist. I didn't even know what a cardiologist was, but my mum watched Casualty a lot, and I knew that it was a job that was like really important and people wanted you to do things. Do you know what? And then I think I wanted to be an astronaut. But in terms of actual specific people, I don't know. I feel like it was probably one of the Spice Girls.
Oh my God. I've definitely got Scary Spice as one of the people I wanted to be.
Yeah, I think I was like, I don't know specifically which one, but I want to be in their gang. And one of my earliest traumatic memories is not being invited to a Spice Girls party that a certain person at my primary school, I'm not going to name names, Katrina, didn't invite me to. It was fine. We're still friends. I think I quite like the idea of like seeing a collective of cool women doing angry things, because there wasn't really much like that before, if that makes sense.
It's so weird that you said that, because I never realized just how influential they were. Like they were a huge phenomenon, and it was because they were like all girls. And then I feel like afterwards we had this huge burst of girl bands that just popped out of nowhere. Like all of a sudden people realized it was super trendy. I mean, there definitely was the Supremes and various other classic girl groups.
There definitely were. Actually, I grew up listening to a lot of sort of Motown. My parents are really into it, but I think it wasn't as like, there were just records in the house, which is kind of sad that I didn't know more about them at the time, because I think my parents just played them. They used to go to like Northern Soul nights and stuff when they were younger.
Nice.
But the actual, I remember just seeing the Wannabe video.
Yeah.
Wannabe video, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is what this podcast is called.
Well. I know.
And that being really influential and just being like, oh God, there's these women who are like not afraid to like kick men in the face, which I'm pretty sure happens at some point. And now that influences the way that I feel about men now. So thank you, Spice Girls.
So I'm going to pick up on the cardiologist part and the vet. What did you do to try to fulfill that dream?
It's weird because I think I kind of talked about wanting to be it for a while. And I've always loved animals and I've always had animals. So I think my pets probably did get a few like plasters on their face and that kind of stuff at some point, and sorry, mum. And then cardiologist, I think I got really obsessed with doing something medical for a bit, because I was like, that feels like a really important job, but not like a nurse, because I was like, well, no, but I was such a little idiot when I was a child. I was like, no, nurses don't do the real work. And now I'm like, you are an idiot. Like, what are you talking about? Just because you weren't like a surgeon. But I think I quite like the idea of doing something to such a degree that it was like super technical and super weird. And then I grew up and realized I really can't stand the sight of insides or like the inside of people. And like, I've actually become more squeamish as I've got older, which I don't know what that says about me.
I completely relate.
Yeah. Can't watch it. I've tried. as it gets, like, if it's like gothic horror or like horror films, it's kind of fine, but anything remotely anatomical really freaks me out. And then I wanted to become like a, I think I wanted to be a teacher for a really long time. And then I got really big for my boots and was like, I'm going to be a doctor of philosophy or literature. I had no idea what it is at all because like no one in my family went to university. Yeah. So I didn't have any in my entire thing. I think my cousin went to like whatever the equivalent of vocational college was, where you had to go and do like computers and for video games. But I didn't know what it was.
That's really cool.
Yeah, but he's really cool. He works for like EA Games now, I think, or he did work for EA Games. But I remember knowing it was a thing that you could do because I'd watched Dead Poets Society because my friend Sophie, who, again, we've been friends for a million years, her family are very different to mine and they were like super into like education. They're both teachers. Mm-hmm. And I remember kind of being in their house and like watching these kind of this whole pop culture that I hadn't had access to. And it was because they were all university educated and had that. And obviously now I understand there's a weird dynamic there that was there. I'm like literally going, I want to go to university and I'm going to go and become a doctor or something. Mm-hmm. Because university is going to be full of people talking about ideas and like, I don't know, feelings, but good feelings. And then someone's going to like be brilliant and then you're going to end up like writing 10 books and having a boudoir full of interested students. Basically all of American and US like English television about old Guardian Visitor that completely ruined me for a while. And then went to university and it was shit. So,
yeah. I mean, yeah. And I went to one of those oldie time ones that was really like, Hogwarts-esque. I mean, I was right next to Durham Cathedral, which was used as part of like the scene of Hogwarts. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. And a lot of nights out did have that really magical, oh, look, pretty buildings and weird castle roofs. But yeah, no, ultimately it was still like fluorescent lights, dodgy costumes, semi-racist blackface things happening, you know, just a bit of a shit fest. You merge careers like no other person I've ever met in my life. So you are the digital design curator?
Yeah, curator of digital design.
Curator of digital design at the V&A now. Can you explain what that is?
No. people will be like, I've been there for about 2 months. It's very new. So I've been brought in to basically figure out a way of kind of exhibiting and researching and talking with the public about what digital design is. So a little bit historically, and yeah, because there's not a super amount that you could, that beyond like 19, I don't know, actually there's sort of early 1900s, that's when it kind of starts. There arguably I'd say like 19th century, but it depends what you see what digital is, because technically the word digit comes from like 400 BC, which is units less than 10 that you measure with your finger.
Yeah, I was going to say digits and fingers.
That's what it comes from. There's this massive gap until like the 1860s when someone talks about the like counting things in digits. And but in terms of kind of a collection, so we kind of collect items that are kind of important in kind of human history. And I remember on my first day of working at the museum, someone sat me down and was like, you need to understand that you're a custodian of British culture now. Ooh. You've got a responsibility to kind of preserve things for generations after you're long dead and gone. And I was like, so all the crap that I think is really important about computers, that's gonna be there forever. And he was like, yes.
So cool.
I was like, they're gonna hate me, it's fine. So a lot of it is like doing the research and also like doing a lot of public engagement about and of asking people what digital design is in their life now. Because I think that people, specifically because it's so pervasive and it's literally it touches so many things and so many different disciplines as well. So like design as a whole, architecture, art, like sculpture, engineering, all that kind of stuff is all kind of bound in there. So trying to use a museum as a platform to talk to people about that is quite interesting for me anyway.
Yeah, no, that sounds beyond cool. Also, I like that you're a custodian of British culture. Huh?
Yeah, because we're not like it's literally along the line of like you are. I'm supposed to be like. There's some weird little rules that I've read recently. It was like if you're a custodian of culture, you have to defend it. So in my head, I'm like imagining a future zombie apocalypse where I'm standing at the front trying to stop people from touching my computers. So that's what I can
just defend it with your life.
Yeah.
That is such a cool job title, and also a role that I didn't think anyone could ever embody. Also, you're very young and a woman, so that's really cool that you get to be
blagger.
Yeah.
Professional blagger. No.
But no, why you're here is because you talk about the future and how that kind of, how the future and technology intersect with like humans. And I really, that's the part I loved about your talk at She Says Brighton, yes, for context. And I found it so fascinating because you were mostly really anti-tech in some ways, but loved it in really other, it's weird. I don't know how to explain it because I watched your talk back again to make sure that I was like, no, her name is Natalie. And I watched it back and I was like, but you love technology, but you hate technology, or you hate what technology does. And then I was, and then I got confused.
It's funny because like, I get asked this a lot, like, why do you hate technology so much? And it's like, I don't. I think technology's bloody brilliant. It's the reason why we're living the normal, like, let's say normal, yeah, we're living longer lives. Like, it's the reason why we can cure things. The reason why I can get home late at night, and it's the reason why I can do, like, we were just talking about on-demand services. Like, it's kind of great that you can, like, just order stuff to your house that's too far away and you've had a few drinks and it's like, yeah, like, there's a shop there. I mean, obviously, some of it's like, we've just been really lazy and terrible. But the other thing is, like, you should still, like, technology is supposed to be an interesting thing that helps humans, and it's always meant to be about us using tools to extend the things that our feeble fleshy bodies can't do. And mm-hmm. Whether it's a phone that's literally an extra brain or beyond your brain to choose, to language is a technology, like all of that kind of stuff is things that we utilize as a way of interacting and understanding the world. But then there's people who make it really, really terrible, and they, sure, do stupid stuff like that no one needs, like, I don't know, internet connected fridges. I've got a real issue with them.
They're real things though.
Yeah, they're very real.
I don't get what they do. So they just like, what, monitor stock levels of like what's in your fridge?
You think that, but they'll, no, do things like, like, I don't know, that, because I went to go and see a product demo of a Samsung fridge a couple, like maybe a year ago, and it had the opportunity, like, it would be very helpful if it just told you when you'd run out of milk. I mean, it doesn't really need to have that because you probably know that, and someone will tell you, like, my partner will text me and say, you've eaten all the butter again. Can like, can you just bring it back to me with a spoon sitting in the kitchen? But it's that would be kind of helpful. But it's things like calorie counting and nutritional value and alarms. And like, there's one fridge that I saw that genuinely made me really angry because it was just like, it will lock if it thinks that you've, like, if you're on a diet, for instance, you can say to it. And I know that people who are on calorie restricted diets for reasons that that's important, but it kind of, I'm not saying that it should be banned completely. It's more thinking about the where that could make someone's life really difficult. So talking to people, for instance, who have problems with eating disorders, like, mm-hmm, if you give people the ability to enforce those rituals through that way, like, I remember speaking to a couple of like teenage girls about calorie counting apps, and like the whole point of that is like, if you're trying to do a diet that kind of is nutritionally balanced and that kind of thing, that there's this whole culture of like, that's built around those apps by people that we didn't think would do that because we didn't anticipate that could be a thing. We've not put those safeguards, we've not had those conversations. It's not like you don't have to put an anti-anorexia filter on your fitness pal, but it's more like we need to be anticipating the conversations we need to have with young people with their lives with technology, otherwise that weird stuff's going to happen. But technology companies don't think about that, they just want data a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of confusing myriad world where it's like, I do hate technology in some parts, I do love it equally, but it's more the thing that I hate about technology is when it either tries to solve a solution that doesn't need fixing or it ignores the human interaction with it. It just thinks that it's a very objective system and that machines will just do a thing and that's fine. But it won't ever be abused or misunderstood or used against someone, like, I don't know, tracker apps. Like, the worst thing to have ever existed, because they were invented.
What?
Yeah, they're invented to track children. Like, so people would be able to put things on your phone so you could track a child just in case they got lost. Now, the method behind that, it makes sense.
Sure.
But the problem is, obviously, you should be in a point where you shouldn't have to helicopter parent your child. But if you're very young, that would make sense. But then overwhelmingly bought and used by abusive partners wanting to track their girlfriends or their ex-girlfriends.
Ugh.
And because they run in the background, it's very difficult for you to know that they're, yeah, that they're there. And even things like sharing locations. So Apple recently had a bit of an issue with this, where, you know, when you can share your location with friends or you can add friends to a Find My Friends app on Apple.
Yeah.
Lots of people don't know that they've shared their contact with people unless, like, obviously you've done it. But if you've got an abusive ex-partner and your phones are next to each other, you can very quickly do that and it'll just keep running in the background. And all this stuff that's like, I don't want to alarm you and tell you this stuff is happening, but it's more knowing that it can happen helps us have those conversations better.
Yeah.
And helps us find ways of talking to people about really difficult things rather than just throwing technology at it.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, that's so terrifying. I'm now scared of technology.
No, but you shouldn't be, because technology, again, it's like, it's great because it can get you a HDMI cable an hour, which is a literal thing I've done once for an art installation. But it's more understanding that technology doesn't happen in a vacuum. It doesn't happen in a thing where it will go out into the world and then whatever it is intended to do, that's what it will do. It's more people like understanding that it might affect people in different ways, and there's messiness about how, like, I don't know, class and gender and sexuality and all that thing kind of come into it.
Yeah.
Because often these technologies and the systems they're built on were either kind of created by a bunch of white dudes in California, or they're based on data sets which are very limited. So this is why you have shit like, there we go, it's the first one, of the first Apple Watch couldn't read the heart rate of black, like, skin, like darker skin, because it uses green light, which you can't read through darker skin tones. And you see that horrible video of the guy trying to get some soap out of a dispenser because he's got a darker hand than his like colleague. He can't get soap because it doesn't read you as being a human. And if it's reiterated over and over again,
wow.
If you're like, you don't want to tell black people that they're not seen as human by technology, because that's horrific. And people don't deliberately try and do that. They just don't think about it because they don't test it with black people.
Yeah.
Or people of color. Like, generally they'll always have this very straight kind of data set.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I mean, technology telling black people they're not human.
But that's a terrifying flying thing, which
it's
is like
quite terrifying.
We shouldn't have to have that. Yeah, we shouldn't have to have that conversation. It is literally because people don't anticipate. I think that's the thing that I get interested in. Like, the things that when we do, so like, I don't know, when you think about the future, a lot of the things aren't going to happen, but it's important to understand that we've even imagined it in the first place. So the act of imagining anything or putting anything into being or willing anything into being itself indicates towards something that's happening now. That's kind of the role of science fiction, essentially. Yeah. But when you have like Kickstarter pitches, they are like mini science fictions, but they're much nearer. It's like people trying to will this stuff into world and they're trying to push forward an idea or something, but they won't analyze the world that it could kind of think about.
Yeah,
I'm not saying you should ban all Kickstarter videos, but
I know some very successful Kickstarter campaigns that have made the world a much better place as a result. So,
good.
How do you even? Because I think for me, I would never even think about that. Like, it just wouldn't occur to me, and I guess that's probably true of a lot of people, that it just wouldn't occur to us to think outside of ourselves. And that's probably like an element of privilege of, oh, I never would have thought like a tracker app and domestic violence. I mean, unless I probably experienced it, in which case, yeah. So how do you then jolt people into thinking about that? Do you have to go into those technology companies? Like, is there best practice and ethics around these things? Because I remember when we were developing like just a pretty standard recruitment app a long time ago, we were going through like a code of ethics, and it was still kind of like this growing and evolving document that wasn't quite finalized yet. And yeah, like it kind of just seemed like no one really knew what they were doing or what the ethics should be on the technology that they're producing. But how do you even navigate this? It feels like a bit of a mind F word.
I mean, it's a very complex problem, and that's not me pushing it off and saying like it's a very politician's answer. It's like it's a very difficult issue. I think it's because it's so, again, said earlier, it's so pervasive and so it kind of interacts with so many different points of life now. Technology is like from like a policy level to a governmental level to a educational level to the media, all of that kind of thing. I think the best thing that kind of tool that I try and give to people who are trying to figure out this stuff is like, don't just assume what you're given. Always kind of go, okay, so that's one narrative that's being put forward. Mm-hmm. You can either physically put yourself in someone else's shoes, which is very difficult if you're not used to interacting with that group of people. No one wants to accidentally do, I don't know, anthropology blackface or whatever it is. But like trying to figure out, okay, so if I was from this personality, how would that affect me differently? Or if I was in this particular country, how would that affect me differently? But I think it's the way that we usually find it from working in Foresight. I used to work quite closely, or I still kind of do work closely with a group called Changist, who are amazing and really wonderful people. And they found storytelling and narrative to be a really good way to figure that out, because everyone likes stories, everyone understands about stories. But if you get people to work with you to create a story that they kind of unfold themselves, and do things like, okay, so either using a provocative object or a storyline, and you kind of like, we usually do things like we ran a series of summer schools, and we still do summer schools where there's a theme, and like you get people to think about, okay, so in 5 years, this is your timeline, what are the things that could happen? Mm-hmm. What kind of so you have the thing that's called the futures cone. I think I might have mentioned it, as she says. There's three possible timelines. There's the things that are probable. So for instance, the sun is going to rise tomorrow, we think. Have the plausible, which is based on current knowledge. It could happen, but it's not completely certain. Well, it's less certain than probable, which is Theresa May might not be prime minister by May.
That'd be great.
I agree. And then you have possible, which is like it probably isn't going to happen, but it could be sort of knowledge there, which is like Brexit's never going to happen. I've become very cynical now, but the idea of like mapping out that stuff on that timeline, and you do it over 5 years, and you get people to start just imagining, okay, so if in 5 years' time it could be possible that Brexit won't happen, what steps were leading up to that from point zero to now that which would enable that to maybe people might change the mind about that kind of thing. And you get people to think along like social, technical, economic, environmental, political, legal. This is a thing called steeple. But you get people to think about things across different things. But I think the key thing for me is like the reason why storytelling is really important is because it's not about numbers and data and charts and reports. It's like the reason why literary fiction is amazing and makes a lot of people kind of more rounded, and that's my degree in literature kind of talking, they enable you to kind of see things from different perspectives and think differently about the world, and like use narrative as a way to work through something that's really difficult. Mm-hmm. So if you can get people if you said to people like some horrible, terrible scenario, but if you tell them a story about it, it's a bit more you can break it down a little bit easier.
Yeah.
But I don't, I guess it's like one of those things that when you start to, it's like questioning everything, question everything. Don't just take everything at face value. Like if like when you read a story, why do they get to be the hero of the story? Like what happened? Like what about the girl at the bus stop, as Nick Foster says in his amazing essay called The Future Mundane? Don't design and don't think about Tom Cruise in this situation, but what about the girl at the bus stop who's got two kids that she's got to get home? Like where does their experience of this story affect them? Like this guy driving his car through a street probably is going to disrupt her bus route now.
Yeah, I want to know what the worst advice you've ever received was and what the best advice you've ever received was.
God, that's a great question. The best advice is easier. I know it's a really, really, really corny, but it's someone just basically saying like, you don't need, actually it's my friend Tobias who said that like, you don't need to I often say at the end of sentences, if that makes sense, or if you get me, or if like, if you, it's because of my own insecurity of about not being understood.
Yeah.
And he's like, you don't need to do that, because the reason why you're here is because people want to talk to you, but you have to be yourself. You have to kind of like, you can't be anyone but yourself. Stop trying to make people think that you're, I don't know, like be very kind of honest about what you don't know. So that's like a sign of maturity, was saying I don't know to it when someone says something, like if you know something. Because when you're younger, especially, you kind of go like, oh yeah, I know that book. Oh yeah, I know that person. Just say like, no, I don't know that. Tell me about them. The worst advice I've ever had was someone tried to tell me to get rid of my quirks out of how I speak and how I talk, because it didn't seem to be professional or didn't seem to be, I don't know. It's basically, it's that horrible thing that happens with women. I mean, do you know about the vocal fry?
Yeah, I do know about vocal fry. Mm.
So I have vocal fry, and I've had someone...
Now I hear it.
But again, I've got a lot of friends who are American who've, obviously that's where it kind of originated.
Yeah.
But I've had, again, older white men tell me that the way that I speak sometimes is a bit hysterical, or it's a bit too fast, or it's a bit too, and like, maybe you should sort of slow down and think about what you're saying. Like, I think about what I'm saying. I'm not stupid, but it's more, a particular way of talking where it removes certain parts of my personality. I think that's a very gender thing a lot of the time, where women are told to speak in a certain way because often, like, I don't know, their voices are irritating to men or something.
Screw men.
Yeah. It was a public speaking
No, I've refused to go to public speaking things. I've just become a good public speaker all by myself. And I love your quirks. I think what I love about watching you speak, because I've watched a few things now, not stalkerish, but just a few things, just one or two videos. Anyway, I watched a few things, and what I really like is that it's very personal. It feels like you're being 100% yourself. Like, it does come across very genuine, and that makes it entertaining. And I've watched so many speakers who have zero personality and they tend to be straight white men. And
I'm like, my life is a joke, Imre, so that's good.
No, but you add like so many of your own personal thoughts and opinions alongside like facts and statistics. And it's like you are somewhat slightly self-deprecating in some of your talks, which I find strange and unnecessary, but it's also part of who you are.
Yeah.
But it's almost like relatable, because I know I do that where I'm like, oh, I don't know. And yeah, I really like watching you speak, and I would recommend that everyone go and watch like Natalie on videos, because
it's very kind and unwarranted. But no, but I the self-deprecating thing, just to go back to that, I think it kind of ties into the worst advice bit.
Yeah.
And like, I think it's because of, again, particularly women, they do fall towards self-deprecating because of having to argue their place in being somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I would really like, even though I know it can be quite funny if you're a stand-up comedian, but like, actually, sometimes I would like to be able to like not make a joke of myself sometimes, especially with the situations where you're asking people for money or like their time or museum exhibits or whatever. But it is, I think maybe it's because I have a real thing about being anti-polish and really anti, I'm really pro-mediocrity.
I love this. My favorite person.
Everyone has to be a polished superstar. Like, because if that can discount so many people who might have weird, like, I don't know, quirks and weird ideas to talk about themselves, they should be given as much of a platform. They shouldn't feel they have to like homogenize themselves to be able to get that platform. It's again a very kind of classist sort of racist thing often, where it's like having to make yourself speak and be in a certain way to be legitimized. And I was like, I don't understand that.
That like was like a shot straight to the heart, because I know that I have changed the way I speak as a result of mostly university lower sixth form.
Natalie is phenomenal. If you're interested in becoming a futurist yourself, then make sure you are following her on Twitter at @nd_kane. That's nd_kane. You can find out more about Haunted Machines at hauntedmachines.com. Don't forget that Wannabe is going live for the very first time on June 2nd. And if you are a brand builder, this session is 100% for you. So make sure you get tickets at wannabelive.eventbrite.co.uk. There's only a limited number of early bird tickets available, so make sure you nab one. If you like how this podcast is made and you think that you can do what I do, then you need to reach out to the Shoutout Network by visiting shoutoutnetwork.co.uk. Make sure you are following Wannabe on both Twitter and Instagram. I love interacting and seeing your comments and your thoughts on the episodes, so make sure you're following at Wannabe Podcast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please do leave a rating and a review on iTunes if you are using an Apple device. And I will see you again next week. Bye.